My first guest on the program is Allison Weir. She is the executive director of the organization called If Americans Knew, and she writes and speaks widely on Israel and Palestine. We spoke earlier this morning, and I asked Allison, how are South Dakotans connect to Israeli and Palestinian issues?
Well, one of the most direct ways is our tax money. We give to tiny Israel more of our tax money than we'd give to any other country in the world. We give it over $8 million per day of our tax money. This is far more than we give all the starving countries of Africa put together. Our government consistently vetoes efforts by the rest of the world to do something that would bring some sort of resolution or at least peace to the region. And yet, because there's this a very powerful lobby in Washington, D.C. for Israel, they pretty much buy our politicians and drive our policies.
Why?
They're devoted to Israel. You know, unfortunately, there's an organization called the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Its whole purpose is to advocate for Israel. Fortune magazine calls it one of the top two most powerful lobbies in the United States. And the rest of us don't know much about this issue. I was like that. Mm-hmm. Are not sort of think it has something to do with our Jewish friends or something, or it's far away and it's confusing until we've really looked into it for ourselves. The general media coverage, both among conservative and liberal media, is very selective, very filtered, so we don't get the full information. We rarely, for example, even though we give so much of our tax money to Israel, that's a noteworthy fact. It's in the Congressional Research Service. You can get all the details there on it, which is where my statistics come from. And yet the media never tell us this. In all their reporting about Israel-Palestine, they almost never mention, oh, by the way, we give Israel more of our money than anywhere else on earth.
And I'm not going to defend the media, but it's a difficult story to get your arms around on a day-to-day, fast-paced
well,
basis.
I think it is, and I'm not blaming local media, really. They rely on the wire services.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm blaming the wire services very directly, the Associated Press in particular, which is normally very good. There are AP reporters all over the world, all over the country. I have some that have been friends, etc. Most are trying to do an excellent job and are, even though, as you say, daily journalism is extremely difficult and challenging. But most are doing a good job and are trying to, and they're not especially well paid. But in Israel-Palestine, we have a situation where the media is dominated by Israel partisans, so that the reporting that is coming from the region is not coming from neutral journalists who are there to just try to give us all of the facts, which as American citizens we need and we want. When you look into the actual people editing and writing the stories, in many cases they are Israeli citizens. In many cases, they served in the Israeli military. In other cases, they have family members that are in the Israeli military. So these are our partisans. Some of them may think that they transcended their partisanship, but when somebody who's objective, I don't have a reason to take a side on this, looks at their reporting, it's still tilted way over towards Israel.
And we don't know the difference in South Dakota.
That's right. You know, I didn't know. I was living in a small town in California. I didn't know the difference either. It's not until about 13 years ago that I woke up and started to look into this issue just out of curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
When I looked into it, I was so shocked at what first of all, I noticed how one-sided the reporting was, especially by NPR, for example. So when I looked into the reporting and saw how one-sided it was, I started thinking, well, I want the whole story. You know, I think I'll look into it out of curiosity. I did that. Today you can get almost real-time reporting from the media in the region, from both Israeli and Palestinian media, which are excellent, from the human rights groups that are there on the ground, the Red Cross, the Christian Aid, a number of humanitarian agencies. And it was so different than what was being reported in the media that it got my attention.
Mm-hmm.
I began to really look into it more and more. After a few months, I was so shocked at this massive, what I felt, the largest cover-up I had ever seen that transcends the political spectrum, that I quit my job and I traveled. I was an editor in a small town. I quit that job and I traveled over to Gaza and the West Bank in early 2001 by myself as a freelance reporter with my notebook and my little camera, and I saw directly, firsthand, what was going on.
So after now all this time, 12 years, what needs to happen? What needs to change?
All of us need to get involved. You know, all of us need to take positions and do things we've never done before. I'm now often speaking around the country, and people are bringing me there that have never put on an event before. That are, you know, I think most Americans, like most people around the world, are very decent people. Most of us try to live decent lives, treat others fairly. It's sort of live and let live. But we're very busy. We have jobs. We're raising children. It's a difficult economy for many of us. Some are losing homes. And so many of us just think, well, if we're just good people in our personal lives, that's what we'll do. And maybe we'll try to vote in elections and, you know, the media will sort of give us information. But we need to do more, because that's allowing partisans on a very important issue to drive this, to run things, and in some cases to block speeches, to prevent us from learning the facts. We all need to step up into roles that we haven't taken before and become more active in making our country better, in requiring policies that are better for Americans and better for people around the world. It's going to take all of us to do that. We can't leave this to the regular parties because they're failing.
Well, given the situation in Syria, with the Middle East, with Afghanistan, with the budget here at home, how do you fix it from South Dakota? I mean, how do our listeners stand up and say, okay, this is what we want to change?
The wonderful thing is South Dakota has two senators, just like huge California and huge Texas and huge New York. South Dakota has two senators. That's very important. If and when we get some senators in Congress that go to Washington, D.C., and speak out for Americans, for American interests, for American principles of fairness, for moral and rational policies that will make our country secure, honorable, safe, prosperous, then that could start making a real difference. So if South Dakota, and I think this is the state that could start this, if the citizens of South Dakota start saying, this is not how I want my money used, we have need here, I don't want to, it's a failed policy. For decades, we've sent massive amounts of money over there, also to Egypt. On behalf, it's really the money to Egypt is massive also. That's from a deal that was made a few decades ago on behalf of Israel. So we have a huge amount of money going to the Middle East, being misspent, making matters worse, hurting ourselves at home. It's time to just stop sending all that money over there.
Can there be peace in the Middle East?
There can be.
What needs to happen?
We need to stop interfering. Amazingly enough, you know, most of us want our money to be used well. We're careful with how we spend it. But there's no oversight in what we send abroad. Especially, there's no oversight whatsoever that goes to Israel. The money that goes to Israel goes in a lump sum at the very beginning of the year. It's always unanimously approved by voice vote by both parties, who are afraid to go against the bully of the Israel lobby. And it causes the Israeli militarists and expansionists and hardcore to think that they never have to compromise with the population that was originally 95% of the land that they've now taken, the Christians and Muslims who were the original inhabitants there. They think they don't have to compromise because they have the most powerful and richest nation in the world, the United States, in their back pocket. They brag about this. A leader of the lobby of AIPAC a few years ago said, you know, just sort of smirked during an interview and held out a napkin and said, in 24 hours I could have 70 senators' names on this napkin for anything that we want to write. And it's, you know, I think he probably could have more, you know, 70 in 24 hours. Give him 48 and he'd probably have 90. But if we had two senators in there, obviously there are some that wouldn't sign it. But if we would have two senators in there that not only would not sign that napkin, you know, the blank check that's put before them, but would actually publicly and prominently speak out against it and take a leadership role, that could actually help everywhere. It would help the Middle East and would especially help people here in South Dakota.
Give me an example of some of the stories that are coming that are inaccurate.
Well, here's the way that it's filtered. We always hear that there are thousands of rockets lobbed into Israel from Gaza. Mm-hmm. Every story mentions thousands of rockets from Gaza. Barack Obama talked about thousands of rockets from Gaza into Israel. But they don't give us any of the information, you know, some very simple, short information that could go with that sentence. For example, these rockets have been fired for about 10 years. They're largely homemade projectiles, and in the vast majority of cases, cause no damage, no injuries, nothing. Now, how many people have they killed, these thousands of rockets from Gaza over 10-plus years? It's an obtainable number. You could go on, you know, any of your mm-hmm. listeners could go on the Internet, look into it, and count it up. The last I looked, and I don't think there have been any additional ones, but the last I looked, it was 29 people.
Over 10 years?
Over 10 years. Why don't they tell us that?
That's to justify sending the money?
That's right. And just to finish that, because we should always ask, I think, because we do want the whole story. I don't want just the, quote, Palestinian story or just the Israeli story. We want the whole story so we can use our best judgment about what our government should do. Mm-hmm. So these thousands of rockets they always tell us about have killed a total of 29 people. During those same years that those rockets were fired from Gaza, Israeli forces have shelled and often invaded Gaza. So while those 29 people were killed by the rockets, 4,000 Gazans were killed by Israeli forces. But that's never mentioned.
So they do fight back,
the
Israelis?
Well, it's the Israelis who initiate it.
Okay.
The chronology, for example, in the uprising that began in the fall of 2000, was that 91 Palestinian children were killed before a single Israeli child was killed. It's the exact opposite of what most people think. Mm-hmm. In terms of all ages, I believe it's 140 Palestinian men, women, and children were killed before a single Israeli in Israel was killed. So our media always describes, as you said, you know, mm-hmm. because this is how it's always reported, they always describe Israeli actions as retaliatory. If you go and look at the chronology, in every case, you find that it is Israel that initiated the violence that killed Palestinians, and then eventually there's a response, and sadly, then some Israelis are killed also. A professor at MIT did an excellent study where she looked at the truces and the periods of extended calm, maybe 2 weeks or so, and she found, and this is on her website and on our website, she found that when it was a short period of calm, 96% of the time it was Israel that initiated the violence, the resumption of violence. And when it was, as I recall, when it was about a two-week period or longer, 100% of the time it was Israel that initiated the violence. So again, we have the media not telling us about the Israeli violence, so we don't hear that. Then they tell us about the Palestinian violence, so it looks like that has started the violence again. And then the Israelis seem to retaliate when they then go to them. So it's very filtered reporting, and I think at the source, it's intentionally being filtered. Now, I think the media around the country don't know that. Mm-hmm. You know, we reply on AP or the New York Times, mm-hmm. wire service, etc.
But it's intentional. Why?
Because, as I said, in the region, the way the region works for AP, mm-hmm. which is the primary source of information mm-hmm. for most media here in this country. The way the system works there, as near as I've been able to answer, they won't answer my questions. And, you know, journalists believe in transparency, the public's right to know. Maybe they'll answer yours if you try calling them. But as near as I can figure out, there are four main bureaus, perhaps smaller ones, but not that I know of. There are four bureaus in Israel-Palestine. Two of them are in Israel. Those are staffed largely, perhaps at times exclusively, by Jewish and Israeli journalists. That's good. They'll have sources. They'll know the culture. They'll know the language. They'll get the news for us. There are two bureaus in the Palestinian territories, staffed largely, perhaps exclusively, by Christian and Muslim Palestinian reporters. That's good. They'll know the culture. They'll know the language. They'll get the news for us. We'll get the full picture, we would think. Mm-hmm. There's a problem.
It's a great plan.
It's a great plan, except here's the problem. First of all, we did a study of AP reporting, and we found that they reported on Israeli children's deaths at a rate 7 times greater than the Palestinian children's deaths. Even though they were getting them all, it should have been equal, but it wasn't even close to it. So I looked into what's going on here. What it turns out is in all regions of the world, they have this kind of, you know, several bureaus. And for efficiency, you know, usually you sort of then have a structure. And the structure is that one of the bureaus in a region will be what's called the control bureau. That's the bureau that controls the information that goes out. So all of the reports are sent to that bureau, and that bureau determines what's newsworthy, usually writes, for example, from Israel, from the Palestinian territories. Those reporters phone in the story to the Israeli bureau, which is the control bureau. Those journalists there, living in Israel with, you know, often Israeli families, often they themselves Israeli citizens with a history of serving in the Israeli military, that is where it's determined whether that's a news story. If it's written, they're the ones that write it. They're the ones that put in thousands of rockets from Gaza and leave out 4,000 Gazans. You know, they're the ones that send it out
that
from there.
That make the edit. Mm-hmm.
And then from there it goes to New York, to the international desk there. And I'd be very interested to know who's in charge there. I don't know. Maybe more filtering goes on there. But this is the system. And when you have a conflict, you know, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and you have one population largely filtering and editing the news that comes out, that's asking for problems.
That's so it's creating a conflict of interest.
It is. And it's not to say, I mean, some Israeli journalists are very good on this issue. Gideon Levy and Amira Haas are two newspaper reporters in Israel who write very powerfully and honestly and accurately on this topic. So I'm not saying all reporters are necessarily biased, but a system like that is likely to result in bias, and that's what we're getting.